Hello again to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today we have kind of a panel and an interesting discussion on a book. Now we're not Donald. This is not we're not one-time hosts, perennial one-time hosts. He usually does the book club stuff, but we were all kind of captivated by this one book, an old book, written in the late 1800s in Russia. Can you guess what it is? It's maybe three or four famous books from that time. Anyway, we're going to talk about Anna Karenina from Leo Tolstoy today. We're all captivated by it. And the we here is Evan, Gigi, Going Godward, and Nate all have been on the podcast before hosting or as guests. Do you all want to introduce yourselves just for old time's sake?
Sure.
Nate, why don't you start?
I'm Nate, Tornado Nate, and I do a lot of the ag stuff and sometimes talk about trout.
Yes. Gigi?
I'm Going Godward on Twitter, not my given name. I tweet a lot about therapy stuff, relationship, philosophy, theology, that type of thing. And this is, I don't know how many times I've done Doomer Optimism stuff, a few times, but I'm excited to talk about this book that really is kind of riveting.
All right, and Evan, I am Python Rock Snake on Twitter, and aspiring homesteader, sort of making that in the process of that transition right now, and well, that has some themes related to Anna Karenina, and this is one of I was joking, I was talking before we started recording on. Just thinking like, oh, I read this like 2 years ago, and then I was thinking like actually remembering the years. I was like, yeah, it was maybe like 5 years ago. So, life comes at you fast. But yeah, hugely influential book, and I one of my favorites, and yeah, excited to talk about it.
Nice. So I recently, part of what gave me the idea to do this is I recently, Gigi, saw you tweeting about reading it. And I had gotten, by when I saw your tweets about it, I had gotten like maybe a third of the way through. And then I decided, hey, I should like pick that up again. But I actually ended up starting over because it had been a few years. And I just read it all the way through and I was really captivated by it. And then Nate, you started reading it with your son. Did you finish it? And did you read it at the same pace as your son?
We did. We finished it about the same time, and he was gonna come on. And I, like you had mentioned, having him on, I was like, "That's great. I want him to do something like that." But he just broke his collarbone last week and had surgery a few days ago, and not doesn't want to make his first podcast appearance while kind of still in the sea of tramadol.
Yeah. So maybe we can start by, your kind of old, big picture kind of, sense of the book, what you got out of it, and maybe how it themes that relate to conversations we have on DO. So yeah, maybe Evan, do you want to start?
Sure. For me, like it's hard to pick an exact theme or, from the big picture, one of the things that impresses me so much about Tolstoy as a writer is it's I'm so thoroughly impressed by his ability to love his characters. And that just shines through every single person he writes. And he writes some terrible people who make really bad choices. And it's funny, I was talking, I kind of read it back to back with my wife, which is always fun. I highly recommend this. It's like the most exclusive book club in the world to read books at the same time as your spouse. But she had read it as a teenager and had been a little bit mixed on it and was just kind of like, all these people are dumb, they're stupid, like they make bad choices, like what's this about, everybody's just dumb. And then she reread it as an adult and she was like, they're dumb. And I love them because they're dumb. And I'm dumb and we're all dumb. And it was just, that kind of revelation of you recognize in the choices these people make, like the same patterns that we all have in our thoughts, in our relationships, in our choices. And you recognize even when these terrible people are making terrible choices, you're like, I that could have been me. Like I can imagine myself, constrained by events and also making a terrible choice and facing these terrible consequences for it. And so just the humanity of it and just the deep humanism of it, I think is something that shines through really from start to finish. And that's something that makes that I just makes such an impression on me, because I can't there's a few other authors I think that come close, and I'd love to talk about them, but I you know that's such a treasure in the world of literature.
Nice. Gigi, do you want to go next?
Sure. I think maybe this is what I said in a tweet. I just was so struck by how Tolstoy really understood the human condition. He really understood how people feel in these little nuanced ways when they're experiencing something tragic, or when they're experiencing love or joy, or they're faced with death or things like that. He just so understands what we go through, all those little thoughts and feelings. He's just so nuanced in his character development. In terms of like Levin, his character particularly, he was one of my favorite characters in the book. And there's one particular instance where Kitty is thinking about marrying him, and she's thinking about his faith, and he says, you know, he doesn't really believe in God and that kind of thing. And what Kitty remarks on is that he says he doesn't believe, and I guess wouldn't call himself a, you know, religious or Christian person or whatever, but Kitty talks kind of about the orientation of his heart, and that even if he says he's not, she sees in him a life of integrity and honesty and compassion and that kind of thing. And I just think Tolstoy wrote his character as kind of a model. I really think he's just a really great man. I know that he has flaws, and there are things that, you know, maybe he, you know, paints him sometimes in a pleasant light, but I think overall he's a good man. And his concern, particularly for the underclass, I guess, for peasants, for that working class, I think speaks to a lot of people who are maybe in the DO audience. So yeah, those were just some things that stuck out to me in the book.
Nate.
Yeah, I was actually under the impression that this was the seed of a Constantin Levin fan group. I thought that's what this was. Yeah, obviously that guy, I loved that character so much. And so Evan, like you mentioned, kind of reading this with your wife and having a great experience, reading it with my 15-year-old son was incredible. Like we kind of kept pace with each other, and we were both yeah, completely head over heels for it. We're like, this is amazing. And so, and we every night we were talking about the book, and it was just a load of fun. And you know, as we were reading it, he was, you know, as I was, I mean, just so struck by that particular character. And I was really grateful for it at this time to kind of like, I felt like this is awesome. This is like a perfect role model right now for my 15-year-old who's like, you know, absorbing literature and reading this. I'm like, yeah, like go ahead, gravitate towards this character. That's a very, you know, good thing. Yeah, and additionally, Evan, like you mentioned too, just the compassion he writes for his characters, even, you know, the title character who is sometimes very, very difficult to, yeah, like he is so caring and careful about how he discusses all of them. So it's just an incredible book in that way, and captures literal, you know, birth and death, you know, and his birth and death scenes are so potent. And I think one of the things, I guess, a theme that I would name, there's a number of them, and obviously they're mostly related to Levin's storyline, I think, per Doomer Optimism specifically. Pardon?
Oh,
Oh,
sorry, it's my kid. I thought I was muted.
but they concern Levin's storyline specifically, and I'll just throw out that one of the things I really appreciated that over the course of the book, you could see, I mean, Levin's great and but he's also sort of really frustrating at times, right? Because he just gets into these mental, you know, tizzies, and he'll just think himself into like these wild places, and so you can get really frustrated with him at times. And we go through a lot of those cycles in the book with him, and you can see the things that wind him up, you know, like trying to interface and deal with society, and you know, just some of the, I think what Tolstoy probably thinks were some insane aspects of Russian society, and you'd see Levin encounter those, and you'd see him get really wound up and tight. And it was always when he would get back to being on the land, or he would spend time with peasants. You know, like there was like very specifically, and he told in great detail the things that brought Levin back to his senses. And I use that term very intentionally. They brought him back to his senses. And you know, and it's really beautiful how he did that. Like he would tell, and Levin would spin, and then he'd bring him back. And every time he brought him back, it was, like I said, something to do with the land, something to do with his direct relationship with Kitty, not his ideas about that, but when he was in contact with her, when he was, you know, interacting with, you know, with the peasant people that he was surrounded by. These are things that sort of brought him to his senses, and I thought that was really interesting and intentional. And just to kind of see that and then culminate, I think, with his description of his sort of at the end of the book, I think kind of culminated with that, and you kind of got a sense of his journey and what it is that brought him closer to that sort of peace of mind he found at the end.
No, my kid is not happy that I have the door closed, and so I'm a little frazzled. But I feel a little bit like Levin or Anna Karenina at the end of the book. Not quite that bad. I mean, in general, it's about the characters. It's about the internal lives of the characters and getting absorbed into certain internal lives and then seeing them interact with other characters. Like there's a few characters that maybe interact once or twice in the book, and you're like so bought into each character, but then you're seeing their worlds collide. I'm thinking maybe, for example, like, you know, the main characters, like when Levin and Vronsky, or when Levin and Anna Karenina meet or something. It's like, you know, it's just like, what's going on? Like these two things shouldn't mix. But one thing, I guess, overall theme of the book that really stuck out to me was the kind of symmetry between Vronsky and Kitty's relationship. I mean, sorry, Vronsky and Anna's relationship and Levin and Kitty's relationship. Like, you know, when one set is like hot, the other one's cold. There's an obvious symmetry, which we can get into near the end, where, you know, the internal life of Anna is like hellish. It feels like literal hell. Like, it's hard to read. It's hard to read that last chapter of Anna and just how she's viewing the world and how negative she's seeing everything, and everything is just, you know, horrible and an attack on her. And then you see the last scene with Levin, you know, where he's having this kind of religious conversion and everything is beautiful. You know, there's problems, but you know, it's all part of like this idea of the good, this transcendent idea of the good. And that contrast is probably my favorite part of the book, of, you know, Anna's final scene and Levin's final scene. I just think it's brilliant. I think that was very intentional. Like both the symmetry of the two sets of relationships, but also I would say those are the two main characters and the symmetry there. And kind of like really like hell and heaven, right? Like kind of reaching their kind of endpoint on earth. And yeah.
You know, that's something that really has really struck me about it in comparison to other pieces of literature. And it is particularly that character of Anna and her sort of the almost the fatalism of it. You know, it's very. So I love to compare this book to another one of my favorites, which is kind of right on the same level in my estimation, which is Kristin Lovren's Daughter by Sigrid Undset, which is a 20th century Norwegian novel. And I don't actually n have confirmation, but I would be extremely surprised if Undset was not aware of had not read this and was not aware of it and was not in some dimension responding to it. But it's interesting the contrast there of the title characters, because with Anna you have the situation where, you know, she's making these choices, she's making these decisions, and everything. At the same time, everything feels like it's hard to imagine her making a different choice because of who she is. It's sort of the classical Greek idea of fate, where your fate is really bound up in who you are, and your tragic flaw is it's your own character, and there's not another choice you could have made and still been you. And that's just striking all the way through Anna Karenina. She makes these terrible choices, but at the same time, you kind of understand how she had to make them because of who she is, and then suffer the consequences as a result. Which is just it's interesting to see that contrast versus, so Kristen in this other book is a very, in some ways, a similar character, similar titular character of, that all this drama revolves around. But there, the situations are set up completely differently, where it's like you can imagine her making a different choice in every situation. And every some one of the choices she makes is, she's the agent. She's presented with these kind of 50-50, branching paths, and you see her following the one that she does follow, but you can imagine her going the other way. And so it's a really interesting, to me, reflection on how we go through life, how we make our choices, and how much of that is bound up in who we are, and how much is bound up in, the circumstances that are presented to us. And it, to me, that question, and that's really an overarching question all the way through, is like, how much are you an agent? How much are you in control? How much are your choices shaping your destiny?
Here, I'm curious, Gigi. You're the only woman on the panel. How much do you sympathize with Anna Karenina? Like, do you see that? Oh, she's just being dumb. She's making bad choices. She's looking at it wrong. Or do you kind of sympathize? Like, yeah, I kind of see where she's coming from. Like, I kind of see why she did that. I'm curious your perspective there.
I mean, honestly, I feel like Evan's given like such a great like intellectual perspective. I'm gonna be like, I thought that I was so frustrated with her so much of the book. I was just like, okay, girl, you need to just have some integrity. You need to just cool your jets. You don't need to be with this Vronsky guy. He's a skeevy guy. I was very frustrated with her. I mean, I understand. I mean, anybody who knows me, I mean, I understand the female condition. I understand the female impulse. I know what women long for and what they need, and when those things are not being met, they get squirrely and they do dumb stuff and make bad decisions. But I felt like her husband, I understand that she felt emotionally disconnected from him and he was not there meeting those needs. I guess though, in her instance, I just thought that she made a lot of bad choices. And I think that, like, I always thought of her husband, even though he was emotionally, removed or disconnected or whatever, he always was looking out for her honor. Like, he always wanted to for her to maintain her honor. And I mean, some of that I'm sure was like to protect his own as well. I mean, I'm sure some of it was his own pride and wanting to protect himself. But I was mostly frustrated with her. I have compassion on her as a woman and just and what she was facing and that feeling of being emotionally disconnected from the man she's married to, but I also feel like she made a lot of bad choices and did not have any integrity whatsoever. I thought whenever she was very sick and thought she was dying, I thought this was going to be her redeeming moment and she was going to, she was going to be okay and she and her husband were going to be together and she was going to let him love her in the ways that he could. But, ultimately that is not what happened. So I do have compassion on her in some ways and on their marriage. But I really wish that she had let her husband protect her honor and had stayed in that situation. Maybe I'm wrong for thinking that, but that was my thought.
Well, I certainly can't imagine that that's wrong. Like, that's certainly a certain aspect. You look at it and it's like objectively right. Like stop doing what you're doing. It's going to end badly. Like that's what happened. So it's like she should have, at many points, done differently. But I really relate to what Evan said. I feel like there was weakness and getting swept away at the beginning. And then afterwards, it was just sort of like you're just seeing it like a tractor beam pulling her in. And there's no chance that she could make a different decision. Like, and then the question of agency is really a good one there too, because I also think that a lot of that was to do with her, the social circumstances at the time. So a confluence of the social circumstances at the time, her own decision, like those things you could just see. It's like, this is like a slow motion disaster. And I think there was the one opportunity, you know, after the birth, you know, there, I feel like that was the only opportunity in the whole entire book after the, she and Vronsky like fell over the edge, was that moment. And you could also see why that couldn't happen either. But like, I felt like there was a chance there. And other than that, I just didn't, like, at no point did I see there even as a chance of making a different decision, like not even a bit. And the most frustrated I was with her character in the entire book was early when, and this was an interesting thing to compare with the other storyline, was when she just was completely lied to her husband, you know, and really was like basically in modern terminology, like gaslighting him. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. This is completely and just like she put up the wall and she was lying to herself and fooling herself at the same time she was lying to her husband. And her husband knew it, right? But also had this idea of like, well, jealousy is unbecoming. Even though jealousy was actually at that point an extremely appropriate response. And jealousy was also something that Levin struggled with to his own flaw. Levin struggled with jealousy and was jealous, you know, and wrestled with jealousy, but he brought his jealousy to Kitty and they worked through his jealousy. Whereas Alexei refused to acknowledge the jealousy and then allowed something to continue to happen because he wouldn't connect with her. So jealousy, this thing that we generally kind of uniformly view, like most people, like as a bad thing, you know, it presents like Levin being kind of a jealous person, but then also working through that in relationship. And I thought that was the jealousy contrast was super, super fascinating to me.
Yeah, I wanted to going back a little bit to like the notion of agency. I feel like there was one other moment where there was in the scene right when she was about to throw herself in front of the train. Sorry, spoiler alert. The book's been around a long time. No excuses. Read the book anyway. But the moment she was about to throw herself in front of the train, there was a passage I don't remember exactly, but where she had a second thought, where she thought. I forget how it was put, but do you all remember that? Where, like, she had this thought of like some kind of light or some kind of, you know, sanity, clarity coming through, and then she was like, "Nah," and then she was like, she jumped in, and that feels like a moment of, you know, if most of the book, if Nate's right, where, you know, it was just kind of this inexorable process, you know, maybe there were a few points where you could say there was free will and there was a choice that was made that didn't have to be made given the circumstances. I don't know what you if you all remember that part of the book or not, but yeah, notion of jealousy. I was trying to think of there was also the scene where and this kind of ties the two plot lines together a little bit where Anna Karenina kind of tries to seduce Levin, right? Or at least really attract him. And of course, you know, when he feels guilty about it, because he's very attracted to her, and then he brings it to Kitty, and then she's jealous. And I don't know what that's, you know, that might be apropos of nothing, but maybe, I don't know. I'm curious to explore more. Like, are these two different books? Like, these two different storylines? Are these two different books? Should they be two different books? Or what makes the whole book a cohesive whole? Besides the brief interactions between, you know, the two main sets of characters.
I guess I'd say, you know, for me it's that contrast between them, and that's the, you know, that's the overarching theme, I guess, is really, you know, that compare and contrast of two in some dimensions similar personalities, you know, kind of going through that and developing in different directions. So you know, you see Levin struggling with, you know, some of these negative impulses. You see him struggling with the jealousy, but he has a, you know, and I guess that's the interesting question, is what is the difference? You know, that he has the outlet to turn that towards growth and, you know, towards a healthy relationship with Kitty, and not towards the kind of isolating narcissism that Anna really spirals into. And that's, Yeah, I guess I don't really know what the difference is, you know, but I see that as kind of the core theme of the book is that contrast between them.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I think like I was saying earlier about Levin's heart orientation. I mean, I think from the very beginning, you see Anna as having a certain orientation, like in terms of like posture of her heart. I mean, it is kind of like you're saying, it's a little narcissistic. It's kind of turned inward. And Levin is always turned outward. I feel like he's always looking around, thinking about the world around him. And not so much focusing on his, I mean, he does, of course, have an internal dialogue and that kind of thing, but his focus is just so different. His heart orientation is so different. And I just think you have these two kind of opposing characters, in terms of, I guess, just, who they are in their hearts, really.
Well, and you certainly see that to the earlier point, you see that of his grounding in the in nature, in agriculture, in the village life, in cutting hay with the peasants, and that, you know, Tolstoy very clearly wants to emphasize that as you know, that kind of grounding is essential to his character and his being able to, you know, to find a path forward, you know, through his challenges.
Do you think this book is a partially a critique of, like there's a lot of discussion now about kind of agrarian sensibility and a cosmopolitan sensibility or an urban sensibility. In many ways, it feels like this book could have been written now, but just a slightly different, slightly different context and, factors and things, but the underlying themes are very alive now. Do you see him like, and Nate, you kind of emphasize this a lot, that you see this as like a very core agrarian book. And do you feel that way about kind of the stuff with Levin, or do you feel that about the whole book? Like, are the scenes in St. Petersburg and Moscow also, coming from an agrarian sensibility?
Yes, 100%. I think that was it's an agrarian it is just a deeply agrarian book in my opinion. And from the very start, you know, when before he's even gone and seen Kitty at the ice rink, and he's visiting with Stepan Arkadyevich, who, by the way, what a freaking airhead is that guy? That guy is just the most clueless, like,
Oblonsky. We
yeah,
haven't talked about
Oblonsky.
Oblonskys.
That guy. Oh my God. Anyway. But from that very first scene where he's just essentially like, I don't know how you live with this. Like, he has just this no capacity for this I can't think of the word. This life that, you know, this kind of fake false, I think he would call it. And that theme, you know, continues to develop. So I think a lot of Levin's agrarianism, which he I mean, Tolstoy in great detail, you know, paints viscerally and beautifully. Gosh, he's a writer. And just like these scenes, these living scenes of the earth, of the you know, peasantry, of the work of the land, the contrast of that with the life of society is just, I mean, there's just no way that, like, that's, to me, that's the point, is contrasting like this sort of
High society, I would add that.
yeah, right, yes. And you know, and just how out of touch, right, and how completely divorced from human needs and human values, and how something like what happened, you know, with, you know, Anna and Vronsky, like that, the roots of that, or in the soil of this, you know, high society of Russia at that time. And that is explicitly contrasted with, you know, the virtues, I think he would say, that one develops when living, you know, close to the land, and in communion with the land, and people, not in this, you know, even the scenes between, I can't remember her name, but his main, you know, housekeeper, I can't remember the woman's name, who is a really neat character. You know, the there's something in the interactions in those environments that's just fundamentally different than the interactions that people have. And Oblonsky's actually really great. Like, he's just a completely vapid person. And I feel like he's like it's typical, like he's the typical person in that environment. And so I think that that contrast is extremely explicit, and it's pretty subversive because that's not the point. Like, the point is that, that's why he ends the book on Levin's story. Like, he ends there, right? Because that's the point. That storyline is the point, in my opinion.
Let me just ask you this, Nate. He does marry Kitty, and Kitty is kind of also representative of high society, right? She comes from that, and they form a union, and he brings her family to his place. He has a good relationship with her father. Her father's a prince, definitely part of that society as well. Like, I agree with you that he's definitely leaning. He has, he's kind of using Anna to represent the kind of corruption of high society, high urbanism, I guess, and then Levin to represent the virtues of agrarianism. But there's also a bridge there as well in that marriage, I would say. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I'm interested in what you guys see. What pops into my mind, I think, is that the part of that bridge is something about tradition, I think, because there's something in that high society that feels very new, right? Because he kind of talks about, like, the prince, Kitty and Dolly's father. That's a person that Tolstoy seems to hold in high esteem. Like, he's held up like there he represents some virtue, I think. And he's much more anchored in a tradition, I think. And it's like, I think that the society that he's criticizing seems to me to be one that has become sort of unmoored from something that's there was a tradition before it that it has drifted from, right? And that tradition includes marriage for sure. And so like, so there's something in that high society that's sort of gone astray, right? But there's like a deeper way that tradition and society have conducted itself over time. So it's not just like society generally, it's that particular time and the way that it started to become unmoored, which, for me, I'm like, huh, that seems like a thing of industrialism, but maybe that's just my all criticism of everything. So I don't know.
Well, to me, there's a really interesting contrast there when you speak about the kind of the tradition and the community and the rootedness of it. So two of my very favorite scenes, and there's such an interesting contrast. So there's the chapters where Anna and Vronsky go to Italy, and they are in this beautiful natural setting in, the Italian lakes, and they're taking art classes and they're learning to paint the landscapes. And it's so beautifully written, and they're because it's so painful because they're bad because, like, it's not even that they're not skilled, but they just can't quite commit to it. And they're like the description of it, of just like, I mean, you know these people, you've met these people, you've experienced, it's like you've seen people go through this, so like they're gonna take up a hobby and they're just,
It's
and
so brilliant. It's so brilliant. I'm sorry, but it's just like perfect. Of course, Vronsky's going to be an artist. Of course, he is. Of course.
it's just perfect. I love it. I mean, it's painful to read because it's just because it's so spot on. And then the scene that I love, that the contrast to that, is on Levin's farm, they go on a mushroom hunt because they want to set up, and I forget exactly the characters, it's somebody's brother-in-law that they want to set up with one of the, one of the, other, young ladies, and they're going to set these two up. And the contrivance that they have is everybody's going to go on a mushroom hunt through the woods and pick mushrooms, and they're going to get them to bump into each other, and they're going to fall in love. And what I love about it is that it doesn't work, and it's a failure, and it doesn't really matter. And the chapter is still beautiful, and everybody, it's a little bit of a disappointment, but it's not a tragedy because they're in, and just that contrast of like they're in the right place, they're where they belong, they're doing a good thing. It doesn't really matter that their plans didn't come together. And just the difference of that between, you know, versus the scheme to go to Italy and become artists is such an incredible contrast to me.
That was another little dig I thought at like to like his brother-in-law, I forget his name, but the character you're talking about who was, you know, in the woods and the real intellectual one. And to me that was that whole little scene
Or I
was just
guess
kind of
it's his half brother, not his
your half
brother-in-law.
brother. Yeah, half brother. That's right.
And the woman that they're trying to set up, she is like a hero to Kitty, right? Because she was like always raised in service and kind of gave Kitty this kind of religious revelation at the time. And so there was also this interesting contrast there that almost worked, and they both the those characters wanted it to work, but they just couldn't actually do it.
It's because his half brother was that was the dig, I think, at intellectualism, really. It's like you just can't get out of your head. You're just so such a heady person that you can't allow yourself to, you know, make that leap. So I thought that was there were like all these digs throughout the book because it's so long and there's so many different scenes, and that was like intellectualism, I think, was something he kind of kicked whenever he could, and that was a good chance for him to do that.
Nate, there was a kind of one thread throughout the book that always reminded me of you, and it was when like Levin's brother-in-law would like try to convince Levin that he should care about these like larger scale societal things about like national education, and Levin was always like, well, but it doesn't connect with me. I know that maybe I'm a bad person for not wanting to take on these large responsibilities, but it's not like rooted in who I am or what I want. And that actually reminds me of what you said, Gigi, of how he's always looking outward, but he wasn't always looking outward of like reading the newspaper about world events. It was outward in front of him. It was not outward in an abstract way. It was abstract, but it was rooted in what he was very much engaged in. So either of you want to pick up on that?
I don't know if this is going to speak to what you're saying, but I wanted to talk a little bit about that piece where the education piece where he was reluctant to encourage the people who work for him to like have access to like education, like make education compulsory. And there was kind of the point where I don't remember who it was he was in conversation with, but they were just talking about like, well, then they'll be able to see a life that they could have if they had this education, then they can see a life that they could have. He goes, yeah, see it and not be able to attain it. Like, what good is it for them to learn about a life that they can never have or aspire to? I mean, they're just going to learn about it and be bitter that they can't have that life. And so I just thought his perspective on like compulsory education, like they were doing in other parts of Europe, was really interesting. And Levin was kind of opposed to that, and he gave his reasons why. And I just thought that was a really interesting little piece about education.
Yeah, and that was all like a piece with you know what you described, Jason, and there was a scene later in the book, I think, that tied into that, which I felt I was just delighted by because I feel like it was near the end of the book and I was just enraptured with it. And then there was a scene to me out of nowhere where they're talking about the war, I think, wherever it was, Serbia or Kosovo, I don't remember. And you know, he just goes on to talk about, you know, his perspective on war, which is basically like, I don't know, it's not here. Why, you know, why are we like, it just might, again, my perspective almost completely on a lot of these issues that it's like we're t taking he refuses or doesn't understand like why I should, you know, care and take responsibility for problems that I can't really do anything about, and that I'm likely to, by trying to do something about it, you know, make bigger problems and make worse. You know, my life is here, my surroundings are here, the things I can influence are here, my heart is here. You know, why are you telling me I'm supposed to care about these things a half a world away, or these issues that are not present in our, like the people, like we had, like he was just really resistant to these invasive ideas that he felt were going to change and corrupt either, you know, like his immediate surroundings, or, you know, like send people I thought it was interesting too, the people he described as going to that war too, and like they, being valorized and heroized, and maybe that was not so much the case. I just really enjoyed his treatment of the war. I'm like, you just stuck that in. I felt like you stuck that in just for me. Thanks, Leo.
I missed a little tidbit back when you were talking about the agrarian theme of the book. When I immediately Levin's character, I think Nate said this too, like Levin's character, in my opinion, because of how he modeled that character, who he made him be, like he kind of made him the star of the show in a way, just his life, and he was the agrarian. I think that Tolstoy is definitely a localist agrarian. I think he's pro-localism, pro-agrarianism. And so I think this book is so good for the doomer optimism crowd. I think it affirms what we all believe and where like our attention should be focused. I don't know that just want to add a little tidbit.
This might be getting kind of geeky, but I kind of want to talk about the book he was trying to write and like what he was trying to figure out about agriculture. And it seemed like I was having a little bit of trouble, like because he was confused himself after he, kind of a little bit later in the book where he's kind of coming to this conclusion. Like he tries, for example, okay, like let me have a relationship with the peasants where instead of me being the landlord and then working, they're like co-owners or something. Like he's flirting with some kind of cooperative model. But he never, but the peasants themselves are skeptical of it, right? Because they're not sure what this is. It's different. They're not, it might be too risky for them to not like feel like they're just getting a wage or something. I'm curious what you all thought about this book he was trying to write, and what was the fundamental question he was trying to answer?
I definitely had thoughts about that. I thought that was a super interesting subplot as well. Especially, I think if you put it in context of just that, like 60 years, not that I'm an expert on this at all, but like that's six, basically 50, 60 years of Russian history, which went from, like freeing the serfs, basically, which so it seems to me, and again, I don't know that much about Russian history, but it seems clear from the book and what little I do know that this took place in a period of pretty rapid social change, different leadership, relationship to the Tsar, land reform. It seems like it happened. The serfs had been freed, so there was a peasant class, but they didn't really know what to do with themselves. It didn't seem like very well. Like it was like still people used to kind of being serfs, so there was this period of change, and then fast forward a number of years, and then you have the revolution, right, which would lead to the people who did whatever they did figure out. The people who figured that out would then later be killed or sent away, in the purge of the kulaks. So it's sort of a really interesting period to look at this. It's like this interim where they're trying to figure out like how does this relationship to the land work, and how labor, and who owns the labor, and you had and it was sort of like you have the essentially the failure of a peasantry in a really way to develop into a peasantry. It seems like that's sort of what was happening, is there was like a reluctance. There were a few models. There was the one peasant farmer I think he interacted with that seemed to have kind of started to figure that out.
Right,
But in
that one very successful peasant
yep.
was probably becoming a kulak, who would then be
Yes.
purged later on, right?
Right. He figured it out. Like he was doing it. He was the person who would have been like, yeah, like that's this is a good model for how you can, work the land and have, but oops, they went a different direction.
Right. Well, I like to speculate that if Levin, in an alternative timeline, if Levin had been successful in like writing his book, figuring it out, and those reforms actually being influential, maybe the Bolshevik Revolution would have been avoided.
Right. Yeah. Or
Right?
because,
Like
and I
if they
think,
adopted some kind of more cooperative model where, small scale, not into, technology for technology's sake, but what's appropriate, et cetera, et cetera. the impetus towards the Bolshevik Revolution, the popular support wouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
It's just my speculation.
Yeah, and I think that that's sort of like the question that you're asking, I think, is the same one that we're still pondering. It's been a lot of time, on the podcast and our discussions that we have of like well, what is the relationship between a land and a people, and how do you organize that, and how does technology fit into that, and whose responsibility, who's the decision maker, who's responsible, like all the questions we're still asking. Are ones that I think that was the topic of Levin's book was, how do we organize ourselves on the land? Who owns it? And that's something that Tolstoy himself, I think, really obviously he thought about in the book. But at the end of his life, he wanted to give away his, I forget the name of it, but his estate. His wife was like, "Hell no, you're not going to do that." But he wanted to give it away because he didn't believe in ownership anymore. Like that's what. So I think he's. Through his character of Levin is sort of struggling with this: what's an ownership model for the land? How do you live on it? Who owns the land? Who's responsible for the land?
Evan, do you have any thoughts about like Levin's book and what he was trying to get at?
I don't know that I have much to add to what Nate said there. I think, it's an interesting question. As far as the book within a book, like what vision did Levin have? And also, for the purpose of Levin's character, like how much is the book a foil for what he eventually ends up figuring out? And maybe the book is a stand-in for this kind of over-intellectualized way of analyzing the world. And maybe the answer that Tolstoy gives is, hey, stop thinking about it so much, just go work the land. And the answer, and maybe there isn't an answer. Maybe that's just you do the work that's presented before you. That's I guess that's kind of how I would approach it.
Nice. Let's see, what
The
other
problem being with that, like I think, and again, I think that this seems like something Tolstoy struggled with his whole life until he died was. And it takes a really ominous, like there's the ominous overshadowing of that we all know what happened next, right? So it's like Levin needed to actually be thinking about it. It's like, no, don't just like, because if you don't think about it, like there's this horrendous thing coming down the pike that if you don't solve this problem, it's going to, and it does, and he doesn't. So it's kind of like, yeah, don't think about
Of
it, but
course,
then at the same
Tolstoy
time, it's
also didn't know that this was coming down the pike.
exactly,
Right. So
exactly. So it's
maybe,
like this thing that
although, I
we
mean,
know.
you would
He
have answered that
seems to
question
have had
for.
some inklings. I mean, he knew something was coming. I mean, he certainly his other writings, like he was certainly well aware of the unsustainability of the situation that he was observing. I mean, and that's very clear. I mean, he certainly, I mean, I don't think he was had, prophetic view of what was exactly how it was going to come, but I think there's no question he knew that Russian society was sitting on a volcano.
So are we replaying that history now in the United States? And again, it's like, different circumstance, but we all kind of have a sense that the status quo is unsustainable for a variety of reasons. It could go down a very dark path unless we figure out something out that's very fundamental. Is this like a cautionary tale for like, okay, Levin couldn't figure it out, obviously. Of course, he's not a real character, he's a fictional character, but if there was a real life Levin, he didn't figure it out. Are we going
I
to read?
think real life Levin was Leo Tolstoy, actually.
Yeah, probably. So what's that cautionary tale of like, what do we have to figure out that Tolstoy did not figure out to prevent, a similar kind of fate?
I
Like.
guess I'm the one who my bio says 85% optimist. So, I certainly don't think we are in anywhere near as volatile of a situation in terms of, people having a large mass of people who are disenfranchised, politically and economically on anything like the same sort of scale, of Russia in Tolstoy's day. At the same time, I think there's, perhaps something that we see there. I think really the example that is probably more relevant to all of our lives is Anna and her circle and the lives of the high society of the cosmopolitans and their sort of self-destructive ennui of, they don't, I love the comic. It's a web comic from a web comic name. And it's just called Different, and it's the guy who says, "I wish things would be different." And the second panel, he's smashing everything up in his room, and the third panel is him just looking at all the smashed stuff, saying, "Oh no." And it's so perfect because there is this impulse of, we have our lives are so orderly, and we chafe against that. And I think you can certainly read that into Anna's story of her self-destructive tendencies coming out of just a refusal to be content with what is objectively a pretty decent situation. I think I think that side of the story is really the more relevant one to our day and age.
What's really interesting in real quick, what's really interesting in that is that leading up to the affair, right? He did not spend much time. He did not paint Aunt, Anna as like a very like a deeply unhappy person. Like she didn't seem like she was miserable in her marriage. Like it didn't like he didn't go into that at all. It didn't sound like it was all after the affair, and you never could tell if she just retroactively decided that her marriage was terrible because she got swept away in this, or if it was, it didn't seem like it was terrible that, and then that led to this. It seemed like she got swept up in something and sort of retroactively then told the story to herself about how miserable she was. But I don't know. He doesn't go into it. I think he really like leaves that pretty ill-defined. He does not spend a lot of time talking, any time talking about how unhappy she was before Vronsky happened. I just thought it was kind of interesting.
Are any of the characters in the story villains? Like that we would describe as villains?
I think Vronsky's a villain.
Really? He's just a charming young lad who.
No. No, I
He's a
think he's
shithead. He's a shithead for
I
sure.
think he's a villain. And he's such a coward.
Yeah.
Although this goes to Tolstoy's ability to have compassion for his characters, is because by the end of the book, I don't want to say he redeemed himself. I don't think he redeemed himself, but you definitely felt his character in a compassionate, I did, felt his character in a compassionate way. Kind of, I mean, I think he'd had kind of seen the trap that he'd sprung for himself, and he also was unable to. So he was like fatalist. Like he was by the end, he just this sort of fatalist. Even before Anna died, killed herself, I think he still was like had fatalistically determined like this is how it's going to be because of what I did. So yeah, I mean, he's definitely a hateful character, at least in the first half of the book. In the second half of the book, he kind of you see he's realizing it's dawning on him what had happened, but he can't and won't do anything.
I did think it was, I did find it interesting that at one point that he is talking about like he's thinking about his code of ethics, or Tolstoy's describing that Vronsky has a code of ethics, but one of the codes of ethics was and some of them are pretty good, and but then one of them is like, well, if you want a woman, obviously you can have her, and husbands, if you don't lie to somebody, but if it's a husband of a woman that you want, then you can lie or something. And I was like, okay, pretty shitty.
Yeah,
Okay, I can agree with you, Gigi, that he was kind of a villain with a code of ethics.
I think he's the closest to a villain there is, but I think it, that speaks to Tolstoy's skill in depicting
Right.
characters that even there he like his virtues are believable. You understand why people fell for him. And I love one of my favorite things in art and literature is things where this it's already been spoiled, but it's still good. The movie Downfall, which is everybody's seen the scene with Hitler in the bunker that's been parodied a million times, with Hitler reacting to the bad news and shouting at his generals, and you've seen it with a bunch of stupid subtitles for every different thing, and you see it in the context of the movie, and it is horrifying and spellbinding, like no matter how many times you've seen it before. And it's just like it's such an incredible testament to the power of the art that. even though this has been spoiled so many times over, it's still great. And I think about that all the time with, I think this book is such a great example of that. Like the spoiler, like, yeah, Anna kills herself at the end, and yet it's still just horrifying. Like that chapter is painful, just it is a psychological horror to read.
It was disturbing to read. Like I was having, like I was almost having to stop because I was just so disturbed by that mind.
Well, and the other piece of it that and to Vronsky's character, everything you need to know about Vronsky is told in one of the first chapters of the book with the steeplechase when he's racing the horse and he makes a stupid decision that gets his horse killed. And everything you need to know about him is spelled out right there. He spoils
Yes.
the book right up front.
I was literally just thinking of that very thing, and I was going to say something similar. Absolutely. And that scene with the horse, oh, I could not bear to read that. I can't stand when any animals are getting her. It was a very terrible scene, but I thought the same thing, Evan. Like it revealed who he was as a person. Yeah.
Nate, you said that Oblonsky was this vapid character, but I want to defend him in one sense because he was like the most similar to Vronsky, I think, in the book. A little bit better hearted, probably, but he's the one who held the dinner party that finally brought Kitty and Levin together. And so, does that speak for the virtue of that kind of personality, where he's mostly a pleasure seeker, but he's also very He also just loves, kind of joyful occasions and people getting along with each other. And I'm wondering if, I mean, that's not a very deep character in the book, but is there something to be said, or is there some kind of lesson to be drawn? 'Cause I enjoyed the Oblonsky scenes. Even when what the beginning, start the book starts with him where he's cheated on his wife, but there's a certain levity to his character that was a nice kind of contrast with the rest of the book, I felt like, even though it's superficial in many ways. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I didn't find him as intolerable as Vronsky. I mean, I
Oh
he was
no.
shallow. He was shallow, but you could say that he was hospitable.
Yeah.
He had a lot of hospitality, and maybe he was a pleasure seeker. But I think like I felt like he had many more redeeming qualities, and maybe he was shallow. But I don't think he was evil or bad, even if he did do some things early in the book that were, not on the up and up.
What he did not have that Vronsky did have that I think made Vronsky who he was, and made Oblonsky basically not harmless, was ambition. He wasn't an ambitious person. Like that wasn't there. And I think it was that ambition, in Vronsky, that he had like to, that viewed on as a conquest essentially, that like that ambition was the thing that drove him, I think, into very bad territory. And I don't think that Oblonsky was like a awful like an awful person. He was just, like I said, vapid. He just was like an airhead. He was an airhead is how I thought of him. And it made me wonder, like I actually was wondering, I'm like, man, what was their family like? There was a disconnect somewhere, he and Anna. Like there was like not a moral sense. They didn't have a moral sense. There was no moral, that was undeveloped somehow in their family. Because he didn't have, have that at all. And he was, led, pleasure seeker, and she, followed her heart in this way that was not, obviously didn't take her good places. So, he was good-hearted, affable, right? So he was kind of comic relief in a way, but like airhead was just the word I had for him. It's like, this guy's air.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything else in the book? Maybe we can wrap up soon, but why should people care about this conversation? A lot of it's kind of like we're referencing specific characters and specific events. So if you haven't read the book, maybe not a lot of it's, not making sense. But yeah, I don't know. Why are we discussing this book? What's the pitch for the audience that hasn't read it and we think should? I mean, maybe it's, yeah.
Well, my pitch is almost from like a therapeutic perspective. It gives Tolstoy, like I said in the very beginning, he gives so much insight into the human condition, why we do the things we do, how we think about how we're feeling in those moments. And I just think that if you want to understand humanity better, if you want to relate to people better, if you want to have more intimate relationships with people, this book is, I think, almost essential, just because he does such a great job developing characters and their stories and really understanding who they are. I mean, for him to write that many characters so well, I'm just like, he's a genius when it comes to just knowing people. So from that perspective, if you just want to improve your understanding of humanity, I think read Tolstoy.
Yeah, I would just reiterate that. I mean, that's always my argument for reading fiction in general. So I went through probably a decade of my life pretty much reading no fiction after college, feeling like, oh, that's entertainment. That's not serious. I'm gonna learn about the world. I'm gonna learn things. That's more important. And at some point, I kind of rebelled against that and flipped kind of almost entirely. And it was kind of this realization that, life's short. I'm not going to learn everything there is to learn about everything. It's not going to happen. So I need to prioritize. And what's more important than learning about how people relate to each other in this life? And fiction is the sandbox environment for human relationships. It's how we play around, put different people in a box and see how they play, see what happens. And it's the safe environment where we explore how people, how different kinds of personalities interact. And there's really no, very few people. Nate probably has a much deeper insight than most of us because of, his work and getting to see lots of real world examples. But most of us don't actually see that many real world examples of that many different kinds of people interacting. Certainly not with the kind of depth that you get from a omniscient narrator reading people's thoughts. And so having that environment to explore is really invaluable. And I, like I said, there's just a handful of others that I would say are kind of on a similar level as this, but this is about as good as it gets in terms of exploring those relationships in fiction.
Well, because I'm terrible at winding things down, I hope I don't open a can of worms here. But there's a part that as I'm thinking of wrapping it up, we didn't mention it all. I mean, maybe in passing, but like the birth. You were talking about the whole life experience. He writes an incredible death scene and an incredible birth scene. Both of those, and both in both cases, Kitty is the star of the show. And so, and throughout the book, and of course with Anna's thing, just the other thing that we haven't talked about quite as much is just his view of men and women and the complementarity of men and women and the different way, just the different sensibility and the complementarity of it, I thought was really came through in a lot of those scenes. And the appreciation of that, and how Levin learned very much to appreciate that, versus, like, for instance, Oblonsky, who did not appreciate that. it was like they were viewed as this divide, whereas like the Kitty and Levin marriage, it was a marriage because there was this complementarity between a very, very complementary gender experiences there that he really dove into a lot. So anyway, that's maybe a side note. It wasn't wrapping it up, so sorry.
Well, I mean, there's so many like little plot points that I just want to like mention just because they're interesting, but I don't actually have like a broader theme to connect it to. I just want to like maybe this is my way of wrapping up. Like the scene where they finally meet up, like in the middle of the book, Levin, and Kitty, and the way that they fall in love was like writing, like not writing out words to each other, but just writing out the first letter. It was like such like almost like a middle school, kind of scene. It's like it was almost like the youth of their relationship, right? And then there's the death scene with his brother, and she becomes kind of like this invaluable kind of helper through this process, and he didn't think she would be. And so you see this kind of maturation of their relationship. They have like they get home, they have like their squabbles, and then near the end, they've reached this kind of mature relationship where they kind of understand each other more. They've been through a lot together. So I just thought that was really beautiful. There's one more thing that maybe I want to bring up, and I'm sorry if this opens up another can of worms, but the final scenes where Levin's having his religious conversion, and religion has been a big topic, I think, on a lot of people's minds lately. A lot of people have been having these conversions recently. There seems to be happening a lot lately. Myself, I'm even, I used to be very religious, and I haven't been for a while, and I'm starting to get drawn in that direction again. I'm curious, both, Gigi and Evan as, Christians, and then Nate, we're not really religious, at least right now. Like, how did you interpret that final scene? What did it, like, how do you, yeah.
In conclusion, let's talk about religion now.
Well, this is the final scene, so this is wrapping up, right?
I for me it just feels like and coming from the position of obviously like I'm coming from the position as a fellow believer with Tolstoy, so it feels like this is just the natural culmination for what he's put into this character all the way through. So, for me, like maybe it feels too neat and too tidy, but I mean, I can understand how someone would see that, but at the same time, it's just like, no, this feels obvious. That this is something. One thing that I do think is interesting as a kind of contrast is the path that he takes to it is not the stereotypical one, I guess, in most modern, modern American discourse. And I think it's something that at least in my experience is it's not the one that's described as often, but I think it is one that happens that actually does happen, more commonly, that it's something that happens outside of your intellectualizing. It's something that happens outside of your plan and your thinking it through, and by the time it's done, you realize that it's already happened long ago and that you've been on this path for a while. And obviously from the Christian perspective, like we can explain that and we have terms for explaining that. That's the Holy Spirit working in your life, creating faith in you, and that's how it happens. And but from the other perspective, yeah, it's like, this is something that develops outside of your intellectual approach to it.
But related to that, I found it very interesting that, throughout the book, or especially the later part of the book, he's spinning with these theological questions, especially near the end, and struggling and trying to over-intellectualize it. And it was actually just one little statement from one of the peasants, and I forget what it was, that was just kind of this commonplace, like, oh, because, he was wondering why, like one kind of person was, good, and one was very self-interested and selfish. And the peasant was something like, well, you're kind of like, it's because of faith, or it's because of, his belief, and you're kind of like him. I mean, it was something like that. I don't remember, but it was just kind of off the cuff. And all of a sudden he has this like revelation, right? And it was like from, in terms of the status of society, one of, a humble character, that suddenly like the intellectualization doesn't go away, totally, but he realizes that, what he was looking for is like immanent, I guess, and related to this idea of transcendent goodness that he recognizes in Christianity. And that he just needs to, like, I don't know, lean into it or something. I can't quite describe the theological nuance of that, of those final scenes, but yeah, it was a very interesting scene.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I'm like a, I mean, I don't know, like a hair's breadth away from like being like a, I can see a Leo Tolstoy Wendelberry slash Wendelberry Christian like that. The way, I mean, I resonate so much with the worldview conveyed in the works of those two that it's like, that's, I mean, it's almost complete perfect resonance from, you know, for me personally. Like, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyone have any last thoughts before we wrap it?
I did think, you know, to like answer your initial wrap-up question, like I think, you know, the pitch for a Doomer Optimist style, you know, Doomer Optimist type person is just that whether you're kind of coming at it from a tradition slash social decay point of view, or if you're coming at it from a, you know, a landed ecological point of view, I think that the themes of this book are the themes that, you know, in the, you know, conversation that happens in the deosphere that I'm aware of, like this hits them both squarely of like really right in the wheelhouse.
Can agree more. That's a great way to end it. Thanks, y'all. Take care.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.